Rodney Stone by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized for radio in four parts by Constance Cox, with Sean Arnold as Rodney Stone, Stuart Organ, Henry Stamper, Charlotte Mitchell, and John Rye. Rodney Stone, Part 2.
Next morning was all hustle and excitement in preparation for my entry into the great world. My mother packed and repacked my little trunk again and again.
This brown coat of yours is still as good as new, and so is the blue one.
Yes.
So if this time, Roddy, when you're not meeting great people, you can wear them and save your better things.
Of course.
But only, of course, when you're quite alone. You must always do your uncle credit. There. The trunk's ready to be closed, I think.
I'll do it for you, Mother.
And Roddy, dear.
Yes, Mother.
You won't learn to look down on us, will you, when you're out in the great fashionable world?
Of course I shan't. I won't go at all if it grieves you.
Oh, no, no, my dear. You must go. You'll never get such a chance again. But one thing, Roddy, you must promise me. Not to gamble. You heard last night the dreadful things that can come of it.
I promise, truly.
And remember not to cast your winter underclothing until June is in.
Oh, Mother.
And take care how you cross the London streets, for I hear the Cackney coaches are past all imagination.
Now, Mary. That's enough. The boy will be in a maze trying to remember all your injunctions. Here's 20 guineas for you, Roddy.
Oh.
I wish it were more, but it's all I can spare till my prize money comes.
Oh, I don't want half so much, Father.
Take it, lad. You must have a trifle to spend. I won't be beholden to your uncle for everything.
Thank you, Father. I won't ask you for more.
Uh-huh. Put on your travelling coat now.
Yes.
Let your uncle see you looking all spruce and ship-shape. Ah! Good morning, Sir Charles.
Good morning, Lieutenant. Good morning, Mary.
You slept well, I trust, Charles.
Like an infant, Mary. A country heir must agree with me. Well, nephew, what do you think of the prospect of coming to town with me?
Oh, I thank you, sir, for the kind interest you take in me.
Ah, but you must be a credit to me. My nephew must be of the best, if he's to be in keeping with the rest of him.
You'll find him a chip of good wood, sir.
We must make him a polished chip before we've done with him. It's not a question of wealth, you understand. Mere riches cannot do it. Golden Price has 40,000 a year, but his clothes are disastrous. I saw him coming down St. James's Street the other day, and I was so shocked at his appearance that I had to step into Verney's for a glass of brandy. No. No, it's a question of natural taste and following the advice and example of those who are more experienced than yourself.
I fear, Charles, that Roddy's wardrobe is country-made.
Ah, but you'll soon set that right when we get to town. We must keep him quiet until he has some clothes to wear.
That's his best suit, Charles.
Oh, my dear Mary, those clothes are very well for Friar's Oak, but they might seem a little countrified in the mall. However, leave him in my hands, and I shall see to the matter.
On how much, sir, can a young man dress in town?
Oh, with prudence and reasonable care, a young man of fashion can dress upon 800 a year.
800? Oh, handsome.
I fear, Sir Charles, that Roddy must keep his country clothes, even with my prize money.
No, the matter's my concern, Lieutenant. If my nephew comes with me, my nephew is my care. I already owe Weston something over 1,000, so how could a few odd hundreds affect
me?
No, the point is settled, and I must refuse to argue about it. By the way, now that I'm in Friar's Oak, there is another small piece of business I have to perform. I believe there is a fighting man here named Harrison. I should like to have a word with him.
Oh, he keeps the smithy, sir, a little way down the street.
Ah. Then perhaps you'd show me the place, nephew.
Yes, sir.
We'll be back anon, Mary, to say goodbye.
How proud I was to walk down the street with my magnificent uncle. I could see out of the corner of my eye how the folk came to the doors and windows to see us pass. Champion Harrison was standing outside the smithy, and he pulled off his cap when he saw my uncle.
Good morning, dear Harrison.
Hey. Sir Charles Tregellis. God bless me, sir. Who'd have thought of seeing you here?
Well, I'm off in a moment. Nephew, go and tell him to bring the curricle round, will you?
Yes, sir.
You have not changed, Harrison. You look as fit as ever.
Well, my trade keeps me fit, sir.
Yes. With a week's training, I'd say you'd be as good as you were before. What's your scale now?
13-10, Sir Charles. I'm in my 40th year, but I'm sound in wind and limb. If my old woman let me off my promise, I'd have better try with some of these young ones before now. I hear there's been some good stuff coming along.
Yeah.
What's that you're saying, Jack?
Ah, good morning, Mrs. Harrison. I don't suppose you remember me.
Oh, I remember you too well, Sir Charles Tregellis. And if you've come here to draw my husband back to his old ways, you'll be disappointed.
That's the way it is with her, sir. She's not a patron of sport, and that's a fact.
Sport. A fine sport for you, no doubt, Sir Charles, with your pleasant drive into the country, your luncheon basket and your wines, and so merrily back to London in the cool of the evening. But did you ever think of the sport it was to me, waiting through the day alone for my man to come back to me? Sometimes he could walk in, sometimes he was led in, and sometimes he was carried in, and it was only by his clothes I could know him.
Oh, no, wife, I was never as bad as that.
I understand your feelings, Mrs. Harrison.
No, sir, you don't. You never could. But I've got his promise that he'll never sling his hat into the ring again without my leave. And he's keeping his hat on his head, like an honest, God-fearing man. Good day, Sir Charles.
Well, I'm sorry she feels like that, Harrison. I had a good thing to put you away in.
What was that, sir?
I've made a match with Sir Lothian Hume that I'll produce a man under 20 or over 35 to meet his man, Crab Wilson, in a couple of months.
Wilson? Oh, I don't know him, sir.
Well, he's a youngster, but he's good. Still, if you can't, you can't.
Your caracal's ready, sir.
Thank you, nephew. Look, Harrison, I'm giving a little supper to the fancy at the Wagon and Horses in London next Friday.
Sure.
I'd be very glad if you'd make one of me guests.
Oh, I shall be delighted.
Uncle, what do you want me to
Hello?
Do with...
Hello? Who's this?
Oh, this is my nephew, Jim, sir. His parents are dead, and he's been with me since, he was as high as my hammer.
He's a fine-looking lad. Bring him with you to London. Now, your uncle's coming to a supper I'm giving to the boxing fraternity next Friday. Would you care to make one of us?
Oh, yes, sir, I would.
No, Jim, no.
But, Uncle...
I'm sorry to again say you, lad, but there are reasons why I'd rather you stay down here with your aunt.
Oh, let the boy come, Harrison.
No, sir. It's dangerous company for a lad of his mettle. There's plenty for him to do while I'm away.
As you will. Well, you must be leaving now, nephew. Good day to you, Harrison.
Good day to you, Sir Charles.
Are you bound for London now, Ruddy?
No, to Brighton first to meet the prince. Then we go to London afterwards.
Oh, you'll be at this supper my uncle wouldn't let me go to. If only I could meet those people, I might have a chance to get away from here.
Jim.
I must go, Jim. Goodbye.
I'll see you again when I return. You may see me before that, Ruddy.
Sooner than you think.
The caracal with its tandem mares was waiting for us outside the cottage. Ambrose had placed the refection basket and the precious batterie de toilette inside of it, and himself climbed up behind. Then I myself, after a hearty handshake from my father and a last sobbing embrace from my mother, took my place beside my uncle in the front. And with a snap, a crack, and a jingle away, we went upon our journey. All the village was out to see me go off with my grand relative from London to call upon the prince in his own palace. The Harrisons were waving to me from the smithy, and John Cummings from the steps of the inn. I saw Joshua Allen, my old schoolmaster, pointing me out to people as if he were showing what came from his teaching. And to make it complete, who should drive past just as we cleared the village but Miss Hinton, the play actress. But she herself was a changed woman. And I thought to myself that if Boy Jim had done nothing but that one thing, he need not think his youth had been wasted in the country.
Now that you're entering society, nephew, you will, of course, have much to learn. Your education, I understand, has been such as you could get at a village school.
Oh, it taught me a good deal, sir. I know a fair amount of Latin and some Greek.
Ah, no doubt, nephew, no doubt. But learning of the pedant type will be of little use to you, I fear. You'll find it better to suggest that you've forgotten a great deal.
Oh, that shouldn't be difficult, sir.
Oh, you laugh, my dear boy. But I assure you, these are serious matters. Do you have any chance of any eccentricity?
No, sir, I don't think so.
Ah, it's a pity. Eccentricity is very much the mode at present. Even some small characteristics, such as having an apricot tart on your sideboard all the year round, or putting a candle out at night by stuffing it under your pillow, sir.
Oh, do people really do such things, sir?
I assure you they do.
But you don't yourself, sir.
No, but in my own case, it's the precise judgment in matters of dress that's placed me where I am. I don't follow a law. I set one. However, to yourself, your mother tells me you sing and play the violin.
Yes, sir, a little.
Good, good. Those things will be of service to you with the prince. Music runs in his family. You must remember to mention it.
It seems extraordinary to me, sir, that with a war at our very shores, people can trouble about such things.
Don't despise the world you hope to enter, nephew. That'll get you nowhere. What place is this we're entering?
The village of Patcham, sir, just outside Brighton.
Ah, we'll stop at the hotel for a few moments to make ourselves presentable. Then I'll take you to the pavilion. Ambrose, be ready with a battery to toilet. Ambrose, do you hear me?
He's not there, sir.
Not there? Well, there. Where the deuce has he gone? Did you see him alight?
No.
He must have fallen off in a fit. I drive back to look for him, but the prince is expecting me. Remind me, nephew, to send a message back along the road for him.
Yes, sir.
This is a most distressing thing. I wouldn't lose Ambrose for the world. On, the beauties!
Tom never from his word departed. His virtues were so rare. His friends...
As my uncle and I were admitted to the prince's private apartment in the royal pavilion, I saw three people in the room. A monstrously fat man, a rough-looking middle-aged fellow, and a very pretty woman. But it was the singer at the piano who fixed my gaze, for I knew this must be the Prince of Wales. The sight of him put me at my ease, for he was a merry-looking man, handsome too in a portly way, but his cheeks were rather pale and sodden, like those of a man who lived too well and took too little exercise.
That was delightful, sir.
You were never in better voice, sir.
Thank you, Letty. Thank you, Fox. It is a new piano, the very latest, of course.
Paid for, sir?
It would be if your damned commons would settle me debt. Why, Tregellis, I've been expecting you.
Your Royal Highness.
But who's this you've brought with you, eh?
My sister's son, sir, Rodney Stone.
Your Royal Highness.
He's coming with me to London, and I thought it right to begin by presenting him to your Royal Highness.
Yes, quite right, quite right. I'm glad to see you, Mr. Stone. Is your mother living?
Yes, sir.
Then be a good son to her, keep out of debt, and uphold the glorious British Constitution, and you can't go wrong. You'll take wine with us, Tregellis.
No, sir, thank you. Me diet.
Ah, diet, eh? You and I should go on a diet, Fox. We're both getting monstrous stout. But what's this I hear, Tregellis, of a wager between you and Sir Lothian Hugh?
Oh, only a matter of a couple of thousand, sir. He fancies this new man, Crab Wilson. And I'm to find a man to beat him.
Well, you ask Charlie Fox's advice, then. Who have we got, Charlie, to beat Crab Wilson?
Caleb Baldwin. He held his own with Isaac Bethune.
Rubbish. He's not up to Wilson's standard. How about young Dutch Sam or Bill Richmond?
Richmond? No, lady. A cold, bleak wind and any black will get his shivers. Now, your best bet to hear this would be Jack Harrison.
Yes, I thought of that too, but his wife won't let him. But talking of fighting men, I hope, sir, you're coming to the supper I'm giving to the fancy next Friday.
Well, the prince can't come. You know that, Tregellis. But you may reserve a seat for the Earl of Chester.
Oh! We shall be proud to see the Earl of Chester there, sir. And now I must leave you. I've lost the best valet in England today, and I must make inquiries for him.
Now, just a minute. Just a minute, Tregellis. Those your horses out there?
Yes. My two new mares.
Pretty. But not fast, though.
On the contrary, Lady Lade. They'd race anything in England.
Those? Damn me. They're only half thoroughbred. You should see my new team of blacks.
There's blood for you.
Yes, I have seen them. They're quite good horses for the Sussex roads, but too heavy for me. I like to travel.
Travel? Why, you and I'd start for London with our swingle boards touching, and we'd have our dinner ordered, cooked and eaten before you saw Croydon.
Yes, that is right. We'll prove it to you. Do you start for London tomorrow?
Yes.
All right. I'll spring my four in hand from the castle square at 8:45. You follow on the hour. I'll double the horses and double the weight, but if you so much as see me before we cross Westminster Bridge, I'll pay you a cool 100. Is it a match?
Certainly.
Oh, excellent.
No, I should be sorry to take your money. I'll see you tomorrow at 8:45.
Right.
What? Your Royal Highness. Thank you for receiving me nephew so kindly.
Well, I thought we shall have the John.
Who's that, sir, who made the wager with you?
Sir John Lade, one of the richest men in England.
But he looks like a coachman.
That's his eccentricity. His wife, Letty, once was a highwayman's mistress.
Another eccentricity?
Ah! Upon me word, nephew, you improve our acquaintance.
And do you really mean to race him, sir, from Brighton to London?
I do, and he drives like the wind. You shall have such a ride tomorrow, nephew, as you've never had in your life before.
Quite a crowd had gathered in the square to see us set off next morning, for Sir John Lade and my uncle were two of the most famous whips in the country. Our two bonny bay mares gleamed like shot silk in the sunshine as they drew abreast of Sir John's four splendid coal-black horses waiting for the start.
Morning, Charlie. Hope you put some ginger in your cattle.
Good morning, Jack. Your servant, Lady Lade. It's a fine day for a bit of wagoning.
Now remember the terms of our wager, Charlie. 100 you don't see us before Westminster with 1/4 hour's start.
I'll take another 100 we pass you.
Done.
Have your money ready.
I'll have your dinner ordered for you.
Time's up. I'm off.
He can drive, Uncle.
There's not a professional coachman on the road to touch him. Oh, see how he takes the corner out of the square.
Do you think you can beat him, sir?
I must. I can't afford to be beaten. Now, nephew.
Sir.
You must remember to keep your weight as far forward as possible.
Yes.
Oh, and here's a purse of shillings. Oh. Throw them down at every turnpike so that we shan't be forced to stop.
Oh.
Don't look so downcast, nephew. We shall catch them. Sir John's horses are good, honest creatures, but not flyers like these. How goes the time?
2:10.
Not long now.
But those few minutes seemed the longest of my life as I sat on my seat fidgeting with impatience, while my uncle seemed as tranquil as the most unconcerned spectator. He was keenly on the alert, however, for it seemed to me that the stroke of the clock and the thong of his whip fell together. And away we flew on our 50-mile journey. Never had I known such a ride before. We were out of Brighton before I had time to recover my breath from our start. And we flashed through Friar's Oak and across St. John's Common without catching more than a glimpse of the cottage which contained all that I loved best. Never had I travelled at such a pace or felt such a sense of exhilaration as from the sight of those two glorious horses stretched to their utmost with the roar of their hooves and the rattle of our wheels as the light curricle bounded and swayed behind them.
It's 4 long miles uphill from here to Hand Cross. I must ease him a little. Stand up, nephew, and see if you can catch a glimpse of him.
No, sir. There's not a sign of them.
If he's springing his horses up all these hills, they'll be spent before they see Reigate. Keep your weight well forward, nephew. Easy, my beauties, easy. You'll have racing enough before this day's over.
We took the hills at a quiet trot, but even so we made the carriers, walking in the shadow of their huge canvas-covered wagons, stare at us in amazement. Close to Hand Cross, we passed the Royal Brighton stage, which had left at 7:30, dragging heavily up the slope, its passengers toiling along in the dust behind. They gave us a cheer as we whirled by. At Hand Cross, we caught a glimpse of the old landlord hurrying out with his gin and gingerbread. But the dip of the ground was downward now, and away we flew as fast as 8 gallant hooves could take us.
You drive, nephew.
A little, sir.
I must teach you one day.
Well, perhaps you may be learning something from me now.
Oh, enough, sir, to convince me I shall never drive like you.
By 11 o'clock, we were racing over Crawley Down and into the broad main street of Crawley, flying between two country wagons as if they were standing still. With every turn, I peered ahead, looking for our opponents, but there was no sign of them. Then, quite suddenly, I saw a cloud of dust before us.
Uncle, look! You've won your bet, sir.
Half of it. Now we must pass them. Show them your mettle, my beauties.
The mares were now beginning to show signs of exhaustion. Their breath came thick and hoarse, and their coats were matted with moisture. At the top of the hill, however, they settled down into their stride again. But as we topped the brow, there was no sign of the Red Four in hand.
Where the devil have they got to?
There they are, sir, on that side road.
The road to Godston. That means you've got the deuce of a hill to go down. Oh, you'll see some fun now, nephew, and I'm much mistaken.
Even as he spoke, I saw the four in hand disappear as suddenly and abruptly as if it had bumped down the first three steps of some gigantic stair. An instant later, we had reached the same spot, and I rose high in my seat as the curricle dropped. There was the road beneath us, steep and narrow, winding in long curves into the valley.
Ah, thought so. If he doesn't break, why should I? Now, my darlings, one good spurt and we'll show him the colour of our tailboard.
We shot over the brow and flew madly down the hill with the great red coach roaring and thundering before us. We could hear the crack of Sir John's whip and the shrill voice of Lady Laid as she screamed to the horses. My uncle was very quiet, but when I glanced at him, I saw that his lips were set and his eyes shining with just a little flush on each pale cheek. There was no need to urge on the mares, for they were already flying at a pace which could neither be stopped nor controlled. Our leader's head came abreast of the off hind wheel, then of the off front one, and then with a spurt, the bay leader was neck to neck with the black wheeler and our forewheel within an inch of their hind one.
Sanam, Jack, Sanam! Don't let him pass!
Look out, Tregellis! There's a spill coming for somebody!
We were abreast of them now, the rumps of the horses exactly in line and the four wheels spinning together. Then, as we came out of the dust, my uncle whistled in his teeth. 200 yards or so ahead, there was a bridge with wooden posts on either side. The road narrowed down at that point, so that it was obvious that two carriages abreast could not get over. One must give way to the other. Already, our wheels were abreast of their wheelers.
I lead! You must pull them, Laid!
No, no, I!
No, by God! Set them, Jack! Set them!
It seemed to me that we were all going to eternity together.
Get back, Tregellis! You haven't a chance!
Then my uncle did the only thing that could have saved us. He sprang up and lashed right and left at the mares, who hurled themselves on in a frenzy. Down we thundered together, all shouting at the tops of our voices. But still we were drawing steadily away, and we were almost clear of the leaders when we flew onto the bridge. I glanced back at the coach and saw Lady Laid throw herself forward and tug with both hands at the offside rein.
Jam them, Jack! Jam the devils before they pass!
Had she done it an instant before, we should have crashed against the woodwork and been hurled into the deep gully below. As it was not the powerful haunch of the black leader that caught our wheel, but the forequarter, which had not weight enough to turn us from our course. I saw a red, wet steam gape suddenly through the black hair, and next instant we were flying alone down the road, whilst the four in hand had halted, and Sir John and his lady were down in the road together, tending to the wounded horse.
Easy now, my beauties, easy.
They stopped, sir. We've beaten them. I thought they were going to have us off the road.
Yes, Sir John shall hear from me about that tonight. I never thought he could be guilty of such a trick.
Oh, it was the lady, sir. She pulled the reins.
Oh, it was little Letty, was it? Well, it's only messages of another sort that I send to a lady, so We'll forget about it. Well, nephew, you've seen something of my mode of life. How do you like it?
Oh, it's exciting, sir.
I'll show you another aspect of it later. Now we'll stop at Croydon to feed and water the horses. We'll get the house in Jermyn Street in under 5 hours from Brighton Old Square.
My uncle's house in Jermyn Street was quite a small one, 5 rooms and an attic. A man cook and a cottage, he said, are all that a wise man requires. On the other hand, it was furnished with that neatness and taste which belonged to his character. Even the attic, which had been converted into my bedroom, was the most perfect little bijou attic that could possibly be imagined. Beautiful and valuable knick-knacks filled every corner of every apartment, and the house had become a perfect miniature museum which would have delighted a virtuoso. On our arrival, we found a note from Ambrose waiting for us, which increased rather than explained the mystery of his disappearance.
Quite honestly, this is beyond my comprehension.
What does he say, sir?
Well, very little to the purpose. My dear Sir Charles Tregellis, it will ever be a subject of regret to me that the force of circumstances should have compelled me to leave your service in so abrupt a fashion. But something occurred during our journey from Friars Oak to Brighton which left me without any possible alternative. Can you recall any unusual circumstance, Neville?
Nothing at all, sir. Does he say anything more?
Well, merely that he trusts his absence will be but a temporary one. Oh, well, I suppose I must fill his place as best I can. But how on earth could something have occurred to make him leave me at a time when we were going full trot downhill in the curricle? However, we have other matters to think about. We must send to Weston, nephew, and have you fitted up.
Well, can't we go to the tailor, sir?
Certainly not. It is not for a gentleman to go to a shop, but for the shop to come to the gentleman. Until you have some suitable clothes, I'm afraid you must remain indoors.
My dearest mother, I wish it were possible for me to tell you how good my uncle has been to me. On our arrival in London, he took me to his tailor, and now I have more clothes than I can possibly wear. Oh, Anson, and his own weren't nearly worn out.
You want him to be a credit to your brother, don't you, lass? What else does he say?
Tonight we go to a supper he is giving to all the famous boxers in England.
Oh.
Mr. Harrison will be there, so I shall hear the news of you both. Remember me to Jim, and my fondest love to you, Mother, and my dear father. Your loving son, Rodney.
Gentlemen! Gentlemen! Silence, if you please.
I thought this was Vittles here, Jim.
Hold your tongue, Joe Burke. Sir Charles is speaking.
First, I would like to say on behalf of all of us how honored we are that His Royal Highness has graced us with his presence.
That's enough. Shut up.
Well, you all got it down on me for something.
We are here tonight not only to celebrate the past glories of the prize ring, but to arrange some sport for the future.
Yeah.
Sir Lothian Hume and myself have made a match, the details of which I will ask him to give you. Sir Lothian.
Thank you, Sir Charles. The terms, Your Royal Highness and gentlemen, are briefly these. My man, Crab Wilson of Gloucester, never having fought a prize fight, is prepared to meet on May the 18th any man of any weight who may be selected by Sir Charles Tregellis. Sir Charles's selection is limited to men below 20 or over 35 years of age. The stakes are £2,000 against £1,000. £200 to be paid by the winner to his man. Play or pay. That complies with our arrangement, I believe, Sir Charles.
Oh, entirely.
Have you anything to say, Wilson?
If you please, Sir Lothian, I should like to know who I'll be fighting with.
Have you named your man, Sir Charles?
No.
Have you found one yet?
I shall name the man on the morning of the fight. I have that right within the terms of our wager.
It's play or pay, remember?
Yes, I've not forgotten. Well, gentlemen, that is our business concluded. His Royal Highness gives you permission to smoke if you wish.
Mr. Harrison.
How are you, Master Rodney? I saw you sitting with the great folks, but didn't venture to speak to you.
What's the news of Friars Oak, Mr. Harrison?
Well, I saw your father yesterday, and he tells me he may be coming to London.
My father?
Aye. The war is likely to break out again, he says. And he has to see Lord Nelson about a ship.
Oh.
Your mother's well, I'm glad to say. I saw her in church on Sunday.
And Jim?
Ah, Jim. Well, he set his heart in coming tonight, and I had to deny him.
Oh, I fear there's a shadow between us, Master Rodney. It's the first time that ever was.
Ah, Harrison. Sir. Not change your mind about fighting for me, eh?
I wish I could, Sir Charles. But you heard my old woman. Mind you, I should have thought it was stuff enough here in this room to choose from.
All outside the age limit, I'm afraid.
Aye, sir.
And Sir Lothian means to make me pay if I forfeit.
Fighters! You'd make very good ladies' maids, most of you. But you took the wrong turning when you came into the...
Sounds like trouble over there, Sir Charles.
Hold your tongue!
Sir Charles! What's happening, Jackson?
I think we're going to have trouble with your Burks. He's been drinking gin. All he's been out of a mug. You know what a terror he is when he's drunk.
Give him a bite over the mouth.
Put him outside, he's drunk.
Your Burks! I saved the hangman the trouble of wrecking your neck if his Royal Highness wasn't in this room.
I ain't done nothing wrong. I've always been known as a gentleman. But now when a man tells me I ain't inviting Tim,
and
I'll say it again, Joe Burke. Let me get at him. I'll Jim Belcher him. I'll make mincemeat out of him.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Shaw.
What is it, landlord?
I was asked to give you this letter, sir.
Letter? Gentlemen, gentlemen, please, please. I have something here which I think will interest you. There's a stranger below who desires to fight to the finish with the best man in the room.
No one has sent such a challenge to us.
He's having you on, Sir Charles.
Does he seem genuine, landlord?
I'll say he means what he says, Sir Charles. Well, I'm no judge of a man.
Your Royal Highness, have your permission to have a mill, sir?
By all means, Tregellis. Let him be brought up.
Fetch him in, landlord. Now, which one of you is he to fight?
I've been waiting for a turn all evening. Leave him to me if you want to see how a calf's head should be dressed.
The young man, sir.
Master Rodney, do you see who it is? It's boy Jim.
By God, it was Jim. But a Jim I'd never seen before. His country clothes were shed, and he was fashionably dressed, and bore himself with an air of confidence. Before Harrison or I could speak, Joe Burks accosted him.
So, you're the one who wants a fight with the best man in the room, are you? Well, if I don't glut you within 5 minutes, may I never see Berkshire again.
Stop! Sir Charles, this is my nephew, Jim. He's no right to be here at all, let alone issuing a challenge.
I know what I'm doing, Uncle.
No, lad, you don't. Now get out of here, boy, and go home.
The matter has gone rather far, Harrison. A challenge has been issued and taken.
Sir Charles is right, Harrison. It ought to go on.
Your Royal Highness, the boy isn't mine. I have a duty to him.
Now, surely you're too good a sportsman to prevent this lad showing whether he takes after his uncle.
Don't tell him the boy's way, Jack.
You've had your day,
Harrison.
You don't understand, any of you. Oh, look, gentlemen, I never thought to stand up in a ring again. But I'll take on Joe Burks instead to give a bit of pleasure to the company.
No, let the boy fight if he wants
to. Give the youngster a chance.
It must be so, Uncle. I'm sorry to go against your wishes, but I've made up my mind. This is my chance, and I must take it.
Is it settled, Harrison?
Oh, he doesn't know what he's doing, Sir Charles. But I've said all I can, and he won't listen.
Well done, young man.
Hear the place. Give him room.
Now, Jim, boy, for the Lord's sake, remember your distances. Don't try and close with a man who could give you a couple of stones.
Right. Who am I fighting, then?
Oh, I'm Joe Burks, I am. But you're going to need a friend to swear to you before I finish.
Sir Charles, you're surely not going to set me to fight a drunken man. Where's Jim Belcher?
My name, young man.
I'd be glad to try you if you'd let me.
Sorry, lad, but you'll have to work up to me. You don't take a letter in one jump.
But I can...
Throw yourself a match for me, and I'll give you a turn. Meanwhile, I wish you luck. Look lively there. Move those tables back. There's fight.
Jim, Ruddy, didn't I tell you you'd be seeing me before long?
But how did you get here, Jim?
And those clothes. It was Miss Hinton. I told her of my ambitions, and she helped me. She's been the best friend I ever had.
Come along, lad. Make ready.
Good luck, Jim. Oh, thanks, Ruddy.
Harrison.
Yes, Sir Charles.
Jim Belcher and Bill Richmond have offered to stand seconds for your nephew. Unless you'd prefer to make one yourself.
I would, Sir Charles, if you please. I know Jim's ways, and I can advise him better than a stranger. But I'll be glad to have Jim Belcher, since he's willing.
Jackson, will you keep the time and referee?
Certainly, Sir Charles.
Half minutes between rounds, I suppose. Uh-huh. A knockdown to constitute a round.
Right.
And I'll umpire if Sir Lothian Hume will do the same.
By all means.
Who are Joe Burke's seconds?
Dutch Sam and Mendoza are standing for him.
Good, good. Tell Belcher to give the youngster all the help he can. I fear he's going to need it.
By now, a makeshift ring had been made from a coil of rope, and under the direction of Jackson, four men were stationed to hold it. Sponges, towels, and brandy in a bladder were passed over the heads of the crowd for the use of the seconds.
I trust, Your Highness, they provided a ringside seat for you.
I can stand with the rest, Tregellis. By Jove, I haven't had a night like this for years. Hang me if I wouldn't take him on myself if my position were different. Hello, here he is. Dash me if he doesn't strip well.
Too lightweight by half a buck, sir.
You think so, lad?
I do, sir, yes.
I lay 3-1 against him. Take 100. Done!
Come on, Burks. Our man's ready. Are you coming, or must we fetch you?
I'm here and ready.
Now that I saw Burks stripped, I was by no means so sure of Jim's victory. Burks looked enormously strong and stood with his small, bloodshot eyes fixed viciously on Jim like a fierce hound straining at the leash, his great bare hands clenched and unclenched in anticipation of a kill.
You're making a mistake, Tregellis. No country bumpkin is going to knock out a man with Burke's record.
I'm not so sure, Sir Lothian.
Will you stake 200-6 on it?
Certainly. If you can pay me.
I can pay you well enough. I reckon to be Lord Avon before the month is out.
Lord Avon?
The agent in Montevideo tells me there's almost certain news of Avon's death.
Time!
I watched with bated breath as the two men shook hands, drew back, and for an instant eyed each other, circling slowly.
Go on, Berksley. Eat him up.
Come on, youngster. Let's see your metal.
Go!
Then Burks, ducking his head, rushed in and bore Jim down into his corner. It was a slip down rather than a knockdown, but I could see a thin trickle of blood oozing from Jim's mouth.
Keep you on the move, boy. Don't try closing with him or he'll kill you.
Your uncle's right, lad. Burks is out of training, and he wants to make short work of it. Keep him moving and stay out of his reach.
Time!
When Jim came out for the second round, it was plain he meant to keep well out of the way of Burks' murderous reach. But Burks was artful as well as violent. Gradually, he worked Jim back into an angle of the ropes from which there was no escape, then sprang upon him like a tiger. I saw Jim make a quick stoop under the swinging arms, and at the same instant I heard a sharp, ringing smack. And there was Jim dancing about the middle of the ring, and Burks lying on his side on the floor, a hand to his eye.
Where's your country bumpkin now, Sir Lothian? Still offering 3-1 on Burks?
I am.
I'll take you in hundreds.
This the old stage is for me. The boy's got a pretty style and he covers his points well. But it isn't the best looking who wins.
Time!
They were both on the mark in an instant. Jim as full of confidence as ever, and Burks with the most vicious gleam in the only eye that was of use to him. His huge, hairy chest was rising and falling with a quick, loud panting like a spent hound.
Get him in, Joe! Get him in!
Go in, boy! Bustle him in his shorts!
Drop! Then he hits Joe! Drop and have a rest!
But Burks was a gallant ruffian who disdained to go down while his legs would sustain him. He propped off Jim with his long arm, and though Jim sprang lightly round him looking for an opening, he was held off as if a bar of iron was between them.
Get your left to his mark, boy! Then go to his head with your right!
Jim heard and acted on the instant. His left and right came in quick succession and with stunning force. Burks received their full impact. He reeled, flung up his arms, spun round, and fell in a huge, fleshy heap to the floor.
Come on, Burks! Make a fight of it, man!
Oh, is he going to lose me £600?
A little precipitate, weren't you, Sir Lothian?
Bring him round, Dutch! For heaven's sake, bring him round!
Time! Harrison wins!
Best fight for a 12-month.
Joe Burks knocked out cold!
Even Belcher limited it so soon.
Well done, young man, well done. To beat Joe Burks in 3 rounds, it's unheard of.
Thank you, sir.
And now, Tregellis, the Earl of Chester must be leaving. A business of state, you know. But what a mill, Charles. By Jove, what a mill.
Jim, you won.
I told you, Roddy, I'd make my name known in London.
This may do for a start.
More than a start, I fancy. I have to find a man to fight Crab Wilson in a month's time. Would you care to be that man?
Sir Charles, sir.
Let him speak for himself, Harrison. Well?
Yes, Sir Charles, I would. It's just what I want. A chance of fighting my way upwards.
There are heavy stakes of your inch. Very heavy stakes. But you'll receive £200 if you win. Does that satisfy you?
I shall fight for the honor, Sir Charles. And because I hope eventually to be thought worthy of being matched against Jem Belcher.
You're going the right way about it, lad. But you had a soft thing tonight, though. With a drunken man out of condition.
Oh, I didn't want to fight him.
I know you didn't. But when you fight Wilson, you'll be fighting the most promising man from the West. He's as quick and as long in the reach as you are. And he'll train himself to the last ounce. I'll tell you this now, because I'm to have charge of you.
Charge of me?
Belcher has consented to train you if you're willing.
Right. Oh, there's no one I'd rather have. Unless my uncle...
Now, lad, Jem Belcher knows more about training than I do. Where would the quarters be, sir?
I thought it might be handy for you if he fixed them at the jaws at Crawley.
Right, sir.
And as I have the choice of pace for the fight, I shall choose Crawley down. Do you agree to that, Jim?
Yes, Sir Charles.
Then you're my man from now on. Your food is mine, your drink is mine, your sleep is mine, and all you've got to do is just what you're told.
And we haven't an hour to lose, either. Wilson's been on half training this month back.
Jim's fit enough to fight for his life at his present moment, Sir Charles. But we'll both come down to Crawley tomorrow.
Good night, then, Harrison.
Good night, sir.
I'll leave the boy with you, Jim.
Yes, Sir Charles. Good night.
Roddy, you'll come down and see me at my training quarters, won't you?
Of course I will, Jim, and I'll cheer you at the fight.
Nevio!
Oh, coming, Uncle. Good night, Jim. Good night, Mr. Harrison.
Master Roddy.
Good night.
Good night.
I'm sorry to keep you waiting, sir.
Nevio.
Yes, sir?
I feel it my duty to warn you to be a little more careful.
In what way, sir?
Informing your friendships. Jim Harrison's no doubt a most respectable young fellow, but I would remind you that he is only a blacksmith's apprentice and a candidate for the prize ring. He's therefore a most unsuitable acquaintance for you.
But he's my oldest friend,
that
sir.
May be. But there's a vast gap between his position and that of my own blood relation. When you meet him next, let him see that you're his superior.
I couldn't do that, sir. I'm sorry, but I wouldn't change Jim's friendship for that of anybody else in the world.
Indeed. I trust Nevio will think fit to reconsider that statement. That is, if you're to remain with me.
Boy Jim went down to the George at Crawley to train for his great fight with Crab Wilson of Gloucester, and my uncle, whether through pique at our slight dispute or from other causes, went down with a touch of gout. Although I saw Jim now and then, I was left much alone. It was with great delight, therefore, that one morning I heard a well-loved voice.
Nay, don't announce me. I'll go into him.
Father!
Roddy, lad! Ha! Ah, it's good to see you.
And you, Father.
My, but you look grand indeed, huh? Your uncle's been generous to you, I reckon.
He's been goodness itself to me.
All the same, Roddy, I'd rather see you with the king's blue coat on your back than all these tailor's miracles.
Oh, I'd rather wear it, Father.
It warms my heart to hear you say it, boy. But I've come to London to see Lord Nelson on your behalf.
Has he a vacancy for me, Father?
I've every hope he has. And to see him this morning.
Oh, may I come with you?
Well, that depends. I mean, maybe your uncle would like you to stay here.
Oh, if he did want me, it wouldn't be for anything important.
Well, you say that, Roddy, as if you were a little weary of this grand life.
I wouldn't like to live it for always. I think there are better things for a man to do. Especially when his country's at war.
I'm right glad to hear you say that, Roddy. Mind you, if you'd wanted to stay with your uncle for good, I wouldn't have said a word. But I'll be happiest of all to see you follow the way of life the Stones have always led.
What about you, Father? If war breaks out again, will you have to go?
And why shouldn't I, lad? This leg of mine is now unwell again. And if I should be given a ship, I ask for nothing better than to spend what years I have to come afloat. Is that the time? We'll have to hurry.
A short walk brought us to the Hamiltons' townhouse, which Lord Nelson used as his headquarters when in London. We waited in a large, empty drawing room, and when at last the door opened, it was not the great admiral who entered, but a very different person. She was a lady, and as it seemed to me, extremely beautiful, though perhaps one who was more experienced and more critical might have thought her charms lay in the past rather than the present.
Lieutenant Anson Stone.
At your service, Lady Hamilton.
Ah,
You know me, then?
Ah, I've seen your ladyship in Naples.
Oh, then you've doubtless seen my poor Sir William also. My poor, poor Sir William.
I had heard of your ladyship's sad loss.
We died together. What can my life be now, save a living death? But enough of my private sorrow. Lord Nelson bids me say he will be with you in an instant. You've doubtless heard that hostilities are about to reopen.
We heard the news last night, Your Ladyship.
Lord Nelson is under orders to take command of the Mediterranean fleet. Well, you can imagine how at such a moment I... Oh, but is that not his lordship's step I hear?
Lieutenant Stone, I'm very glad to see you.
Oh. Sir.
London's full of Mediterranean men. And I trust that within a week there'll not be an officer amongst you with his feet on dry land.
I've come to ask you, sir, if you could assist me to a ship.
You shall have one, Stone, if my word goes for anything at the Admiralty.
Ah.
I can't promise you a first rate, but at least it shall be a 64-gun ship. And much may be done with a handy 64-gun.
Who can doubt it who has heard of the Agamemnon? My dear Lord Nelson, your own exploits in that vessel, well, they must be an example to every seaman who believes that naval battles can only be won on an admiral's flagship.
Oh, come, come, dear lady. You speak vastly beyond my merit.
Never, never. I speak of England's greatest sailor, the nation's darling of the seas. Lieutenant Stone, if you sail with him, take care of him, I beg of you. If not for my sake, then for the sake of our country.
I shall do my duty at all times, I hope, Your Ladyship.
Lieutenant Stone is far more likely to take care of me for his own sake, dear lady, if he is the sensible man I believe him to be. You're an officer after my own heart, Stone. One of the old breed. When could you join?
Tonight, my lord.
That's the true spirit, Stone. I hoist my flag on the Victory on Wednesday, and we sail at once.
No, no, not so soon. She cannot be ready for sea.
She must, and she shall be ready by heaven if the devil stands at the door. I sail on Wednesday. But who is this you brought with you?
This is my son, Rodney, sir. It's his wish as well as mine that he should join the service. So I took the liberty of bringing him along with me.
So, Master Rodney, you wish to come and have your bones broken, do you? Well, you'll have to change that grand coat for a tarry jacket if you wish to serve with me, sir.
Oh, I'd be glad to do so, sir, whenever you can find a place for me.
Good, good. I see you've the right stuff in you. But don't imagine it's an easy service you've chosen. When you fight for your country. Not for money or glory.
That's all I ask to do, my lord.
He's your son, Stone. I shall be glad to have him.
When shall I be wanted, sir?
Oh, not so fast. Not so fast. We have to find a vacancy for you first. But it'll not be long, I promise you. Do you go back to the country, Lieutenant?
I do, sir. My son stays on in London.
Then take these bags with you.
Oh.
And you too, boy. You may have a while to wait before you join a ship.
Oh, what's in them, sir? They feel like bullets.
No, it's something a sailor needs even more. Look and see.
Acorns?
Whenever I take a country walk, I plant them. Do you know, Lieutenant, how many oaks go to make an 80-gun ship?
No, sir.
2,000, no less. For every ship that carries the white ensign, there's a grove less in England.
Tell that to your children when they come to be your age, young man. I will, sir. And after what you've told me, I think if I ever have a ship, I'd like to call her the Acorn.
That would be a grateful thought, Mr. Stone. Now, what is it? I said I was not to be disturbed.
Your lordship told me to rush these to you if they should come, sir.
By heavens, it's my orders.
Oh, no, no, not so soon. They cannot have come so soon. I cannot bear
it. Dear lady, dear baby. Some smelling salt, salva latterly. Hurry,
yes,
hurry.
Your lordship. Lord.
At this moment, my father thought it discreet to twitch my sleeve as a signal that we should steal from the room. There we left the Admiral beside himself with pity for this shallow and most artificial woman. The following day, my uncle's gout still being troublesome, I took the opportunity of visiting Jim at his training quarters at Crawley.
All right, Jim. That's enough for today. Give yourself a good toweling down now. Get some clothes on. We don't want you catching cold.
Well, Roddy, how am I doing?
Oh, you look fit enough to beat anything.
Oh, so long as I beat Crab Wilson.
Oh, you'll do that easily.
It was good of you to come and see me, Roddy.
Good? Why? We're friends, aren't we?
Oh, I'm not so sure we ought to be now. What does your uncle say about it?
I knew you first, and I'm old enough to choose my own friends.
Ah, I thought he wouldn't like it. But I won't ever make you ashamed of me, Roddy. There are men in the prize ring who can go anywhere. Did you know John Gully's a member of Parliament?
No.
Well, he is. And there's John Jackson. They call him Gentleman Jackson. And there's no one who isn't proud to be in his company. Those are the kind of men I shall take for my example. And if this is the only way I can carve out a future for myself, well then, I'll do it so that no one can look down on me. Is that your coach?
Yes, I must be getting back.
Are you coming to see the fight?
Oh, you don't think I'd miss that, do you? I'm coming to see you win.
Oh, I hope so. Two more days, Roddy, and then what will there be for me? Obscurity back at the forge in Friar's Oak, or a place on the first rung of the Ladder of Fame?
That was the second part of Rodney Stone by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with Sean Arnold as Rodney Stone, Stuart Organ as Jim, Henry Stamper as Champ Harrison, Charlotte Mitchell as Mrs. Harrison, and John Rye as Sir Charles. Anson Stone was played by Peter Woodthorpe, Mrs. Stone by Jean Trend, Sir John Lade by Adrian Egan, Lady Lade by Francis Jeter, Lord Nelson by Hugh Dixon, Lady Hamilton by Carol Boyd, and Sir Lothian Hume by Nigel Graham. David Sinclair played Jem Belcher, Steve Hodson, Gentleman Jackson, Roger Hammond, the Prince of Wales, Ronald Baddeley, Charles Fox and Crab Wilson, and Colin Starkey, Young Dutch Sam. Joe Burks was played by James Bryce, and the landlord by James Carey. The director was David Johnston.